Centuries of art has been sitting in the dark for 6 months, waiting to show itself again. On September 26th, it will. That's when the Museum of Fine Arts says it will open to the public again, with a host of new safety protocols, masks required, strict social distancing, and a rethinking of which art is on display. Will the museum meet the moment, and will it be enough to recover financially after laying off 100 people over the summer? Joining us now is the director of the MFA, Matthew Teitelbaum. Matthew, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you, and I know you have been working towards reopening for a while now. Some other museums opened as early as July. Why the longer wait for the MFA, and what makes you feel ready now?
Well, you know, we took the time we needed to ensure that an old, creaky building could be as welcoming and as safe as possible. We were on lockdown during the period we've been closed, which means really nobody in the building. We had to do a real cleaning, et cetera, et cetera. But the real reason, the deep reason, is we wanted to open with two special exhibitions. We had planned them before we closed. They were ready to go, and we wanted to show them and share them with our public. The challenge was that many aspects had already been designed for an old audience expectation. We had to redesign the exhibitions. We had to create safe protocols. We had to take down walls. We had to replace some signage on the wall with bigger signage, or we had to go to audio and not use handphones. All of those things had cascading effects and slowed us down. And
Matthew,
reason,
let me just interrupt, if you don't mind, for a minute, and just ask to give our listeners the full picture. What are these two exhibits to which you're referring?
Yeah, I was about to get to it. So when we're going to open in three phases. When you first come, you'll come to the American Wing. You'll see the great treasures of the American collection. You'll see Women Take the Floor, which is an extraordinary collection of work by women from our collection that has been on view and has been tweaked and changed slightly to add new artists. We'll be showing Black Histories, Black Futures, exhibition of work by black artists in our collection curated by students in Boston. That'll be phase one. American Wing. Second phase will be the opening of Writing the Future, Basquiat and the Hip Hop Generation, which looks at a group of young artists, active in New York in the early 1980s, who made work together. And their work was energetic, colorful, used a lot of text and language and poetry to say, we want to be in the dialogue about what art is. These were mostly artists of color. They were younger. They were multidisciplinary. So it looks at a moment in New York art history that's really resonant today because it's about how community is formed. And then the third phase, all of this is going to happen 2 weeks after each other, so it's all going to happen fairly quickly, will be the opening of our Monet in Boston exhibition, which looks at almost 40 works by Claude Monet, the great impressionist, almost all drawn from our collection. It's the first time in a generation when all of our Monet paintings are home. They're actually in the building, not on loan to other exhibitions and not elsewhere. And we're going to show the Monet exhibition along with a small exhibition of his compatriot, Paul Cézanne. So something really energetic, something really contemplative, something really about history, something really about this moment. So we think with that content and the safety protocols we've put in place, we will be a place that people want to be. And frankly, that's why it took the time that it did.
Well, that makes sense, Matthew. You know, at the very beginning, you said you wanted to make the space both welcoming and safe. And what strikes me is that that mirrors the two intersecting moments that we're in. Safe being, in my mind, a reference to the pandemic, and welcoming meaning this moment when we are working on racial justice in our communities. And for many, that's been a particular focus since the death of George Floyd in May. But we've talked repeatedly with you here on Radio Boston about it being a longer tail after an incident, a racist incident with middle school students at the MFA well over a year ago, I think close to a year and a half ago now. In listening to these exhibits that you've chosen, it feels like this is part of your goal to be a museum that is for all the populations of the city of Boston. Is that right?
Yes, and you say it very well. We have to be a museum for all of Boston. That means we have to have the right invitation and we have to have the right welcome. And the only way you have the right welcome is for the views and the content and the energy of the institution to be reflective of the audiences you desire. And what I would only say as a small corrective is much of this work we've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years. It is core to our strategic plan from 2017. This notion of how do you create experiences around exhibitions and the presentation of art that really make people feel as though they can connect, as though they can really connect, which is why when we did the Nubia show, which we did just under a year ago, which is, you know, a civilization that's many millennia old, we actually looked at it through the point of view of active artists and scholars and students in the Boston area and had them help us understand what this history meant to them today. And that invitation of different voices into the museum is what I think will finally start shifting the museum so that it feels as though it belongs to all of Boston, a very, very high goal for us.
So that's the welcoming part. Now let's talk about the safety part. What kinds of measures have you put in place to reopen during the pandemic? And what will that do to things like the number of people who can come in at once and revenues from ticket sales or people coming in, paying to come into the museum?
So two parts to the answer. We're going to have very specific protocols. You have to go online, order your ticket, and bring your ticket in advance. There'll be no actual ticket transactions in the space. There'll be no coat check. By the way, there'll be no food. There'll be food trucks outside, but there won't be actual in the cafeteria. The restaurant will not be open. We just can't gather people in that way. It's not safe enough. So you're going to get your ticket before. You're going to come to the museum. You're going to be greeted by somebody who smiles and says, come on in. We're glad you're here. You're going to have a very specific route you're going to follow. So there's not going to be a lot of random wandering through the museum. It's going to be comfortable. It's going to be easy. But it's not going to be random. It's going to be in a line, and you're going to walk through, and you're going to go to the first phase to the American Wing. You're going to be able to walk through the American Wing with a fair bit of freedom. You're going to walk around. You're going to look at this gallery, that gallery. There are going to be some changes, some moments in the gallery that will be pretty interesting because we brought some new works of art out of storage to sort of change the narrative a bit and stuff like that. Then completely refurbish the washrooms so that they are automatic. We have hand sanitizer virtually every step you take, so it's there for you at your discretion to use. And of course, everybody will have to wear a mask. It is something we're simply going to insist on. We'll give masks for those who don't bring them. But the idea is that you want to see the people you're with showing the care for you that you will also share with them. And so that will be a standard that we will need to meet. And then as the museum starts to open more and more, more areas and pathways through the museum will open up.
So, Matthew, those are significant investments and significant restrictions. Talk to us about the financial health of the museum right now, especially given 6 months of closure, the need to lay off approximately 100 people over the summer. Where are you financially, and what is the path forward to financial survival and stability?
Listen, you know, you can never say that you've done the right thing. You can never say that you've taken the actions that are necessary, particularly in a context, number one, that's unpredictable, and number two, where whatever actions you take, you cause a sense of loss. We actually laid off 57 people. A number of other people took early retirement on very favorable terms, but in terms of actual layoffs, it was lower than the number you're using. But the point still holds. We're a smaller staff. We can do less, and we have less capability to raise the funding to support the institution. We estimate it'll take between 2 and 3 years to get back to balance. In other words, even opening the doors is a losing proposition from a purely financial point of view. There will be some revenue. We do have an endowment that still, you know, generates some funding. But our standard earned revenue, which are things like the admission and the food and the retail operations, are severely, severely impacted. So what's my answer to you? We're using some cash reserves. We're doing some fundraising. We are being very careful with our costs, and we're trying to narrow the gap between our expenses and our revenues as much as we can. We have a plan that will get us back to some form of equilibrium in between 2 and 3 years if our assumptions are correct. But I can only say to you, it's a very uncertain environment where, you know, our business is going to stay closed longer. Is there going to be a second outbreak? What's going to happen with the universities and the schools? These are all things that impact the operation of the museum.
So with that in mind, what is most important to you, let's say over the next 6 months, as the leader of the MFA?
The most important thing is that we continue to be and build upon our reputation as a cherished institution in this community. The people come, they share, they advocate, they support. That the idea of the museum in Boston and all it does for Boston in creating community, in sharing deep pleasure, in allowing people's imaginations to soar, all those things that museums do by bringing people together is honored, deepened, and that slowly, maybe my wish would be not so slowly, that we get back to a more normal cadence, that people understand that by being in the museum, that act of celebration and experience makes us all stronger. That is my biggest hope.
And that's Matthew Teitelbaum, Director of the Museum of Fine Arts. Matthew, thanks so much for the time today, and good luck with the reopening later this month.
Thank you so much. See you at your Museum of Fine Arts.
The Middlesex District Attorney is out with more than 400 pages of documents related to the 2011 police killing of a black man in his home in Framingham. 68-year-old Yuri Stamps was watching a Celtics game when a SWAT team entered his house on a warrant looking for his stepson. He was ordered to the ground, and while down, he was shot and killed by a Framingham police officer. The DA at the time ruled the shooting officer tripped, and the death was an accident. The officer was never criminally charged. Middlesex DA Marion Ryan is now reviewing that case, and Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman caught up with her just a few minutes ago to ask about its status. And listeners, we were having a few technical difficulties at the time, which you are going to hear on the line, but bear with us.
Well, we have released the documents that related to the investigation done almost 10 years ago, and we are continuing to look at other material, gather things from other sources. So we are doing that piece separately.
And as you see it, what are the various options for moving forward?
Well, right now it's a little bit early to speculate about that. We are, you know, there was an investigation done in the past that reached a certain result. Other material has come to light. We're going to be looking at that, and we'll see where we are with that.
So to take just one part of the case, you know, there are advocates and family members of Stamps who say the forensics don't match up with the police account. Is this the type of thing that you're looking into?
And forensics are always a piece of these kinds of investigations, yes.
Okay. You know, and also you know that Stamps' family and friends have been calling for this case to be reopened for 9 years now. He was killed in 2011. Why is this review happening now?
Well, right now, we are taking, this is really the call that's been made to us right now, so we're responding to that. And, you know, I feel very strongly about these matters. We conduct an investigation, and obviously we need to do that with some degree of containing information. But once an investigation is over, the public should have as much access as possible to those materials. People can disagree with the results of something an investigation reaches, but they should have an opportunity to understand exactly what it is that was available. You know, sometimes what you hear somebody might have said or what you hear might have been something is not consistent with what we saw in the evidence. So it just benefits everyone for people to be able to do what they can do with the documents we release, which is really look through and see the information that was available back then when they did that investigation.
So, you know, no matter what happens here going forward, a man is dead and he can't be brought back. In your mind, is justice at issue here? And if so, what might justice for Stamps' family actually look like?
You know, one of the things that I attended one of the rallies in this, around this case, and one of the things, and you mentioned it a little bit, is, and we always keep it in mind in doing our work, you know, even though it's been almost 10 years, to see Mr. Stamps' family and friends, you know that that loss still looms large in their family. And his loss was a tragedy to them. And that is something we keep in mind always as we look at going forward in any investigation. You know, we do what we're able to do in an investigation, and we get to whatever result and whatever the next step is in a case. But for a family, that loss really never ends.
And can we anticipate review of other cases in the months and years ahead? And do you think more broadly DAs should make this a more intentional part of their work going forward?
Anytime we are looking at a situation, whatever it is, when somebody has lost their life, that's a very significant piece of our work. And when we are able to, when we've done the work we need to do, I believe it's very important that people have access to the information we knew, and they can see how it is that we got to the result we got to.
And finally, any parting thoughts for us?
I think that, you know, it's always important to keep in mind that we act to protect public safety. That's our charge. And part of people feeling being safe is knowing how we do that. And that's why when it's appropriate, it's important to be able to share with the public. It's been the practice of my office since I became district attorney when we do these investigations to post those materials. And we've taken that same approach to this, even though it's an investigation from a different administration. It's important for people to be able to see the work we do and the information we have in doing that work.
And that was Middlesex DA Marion Ryan speaking to Radio Boston's Walter Wolfman just a bit ago. Now, we also spoke earlier to Selvin Chambers, a friend of the Stamps family and spokesperson for the group Justice for Uri, to ask his thoughts on the new review of the case. I started by asking about how he remembers Uri Stamps.
Mr. Stamps, as I always call him, was a gentle giant, a pillar in our community. And I always say this to people, there were two things I felt when Mr. Stamps was around. I felt held accountable, and I also felt safe. And he was a very charming fellow with a big stature, but his stature was not what was intimidating. What was intimidating was really him advising you and you not wanting to disappoint him. He was an avid sports fan, so he went to all of his grandchildren's games, and he went to games at the Cambridge Latin High School for kids that weren't related to him. You know, he was at every one of the basketball games, and the impact of him getting killed by the Framingham police had a rippling effect throughout our community. So it was very sad, not just for his family, but for anyone that kind of came across his path, and he was that impactful. And so we're really looking to keep his memory alive and also pushing forward to make sure that justice is done in regards to the officer Paul Duncan, who allegedly said he accidentally shot Mr. Stamps, but violated every SWAT team safety rule.
Let's back up there for a minute, Selvin, and I do want to get into that, but let's start with the rally that you're attending at the State House later today. Tell us about that and why you're attending the rally.
So the rally is being hosted by Mass Action, and there will be several different groups who will be there, and in particular family members from different people who have been impacted by police brutality or whose life was taken at the hands of the police. And the whole focus is to really bring awareness to the issues at hand and to also command justice for many people who have been impacted by police brutality and police violence.
So the Middlesex County DA, Ryan, has begun releasing records, looking at the documents herself. What is your desired outcome from that? And is that what you wanted DA Ryan to do?
Well, we're glad that's taken place, but that's just the first step. You know, this case never went through a criminal process. And I think that some people think because you won a civil case that you also went through a criminal process. That is not the case. And for us, you know, we want Paul Duncan to be held accountable.
The officer who shot.
Yes,
Mr.
who
Shanks.
Shot him. Yes. You know, when you look at some of the information about the trajectory of the bullet and it being an accident, and it just doesn't match up with the forensics. And the fact that they had the person they were looking for outside of the home and still thought they had to do a raid. And now if you look into it, they had a nonviolent search, drug search warrant, nonviolent, which means that's usually a knock on the door, your police officers show up and they ask for Jane or John Doe. In this case, they decided, even though it was a nonviolent drug search warrant, they sent a SWAT team. That makes absolutely no sense. So therefore, the Framingham police were looking for some action.
I do need to point out there that the former district attorney of the Middlesex County did determine that the officer who fired the fatal round did so accidentally. It sounds like you don't find that a plausible finding.
No, don't find it plausible because of the evidence that was presented. And if you look at some of the documents, I believe that he only got a statement from Paul Duncan himself explaining what happened.
The officer again.
Yes. And so we find that just appalling.
Are you looking for criminal prosecution of Officer Duncan?
Well, I think we want justice, right? So if justice is he loses his job and he's no longer in that, we want justice. Justice was not done. Having a civil case settled out of court, you know, and giving money to people for loss of a loved one, you can never put a price on someone's life, right? It's never going to bring him back, right? It did not serve justice to the person who inflicted the pain.
Do you think that DA Marion Ryan will reopen the case or take new action when her review of these documents that have been released is done?
That is our hope. We're hoping that there's a deep dive into this information and that justice is done.
Yuri Stamps was killed by police in 2011. That's 9 years ago now. And we are now in an incredible moment where it seems the whole country is reckoning with police violence, police brutality, the role of police in our society. Are you reflecting on his death differently now in this new moment? Do you think the world is ready to reflect on his death differently now?
I think the world's reflecting on his death and George Floyd and Eric Brown. So if you look at the atrocities across the country, you know, the whole world's looking at it. People are paying attention. You know, when you look at the faces in a crowd at a rally, when they're not only brown people, you know, but there's a diverse group of people who are standing and demanding justice, that's a good thing, right? So that wasn't happening in the 60s. You had mostly people of color. You did have some white folks that were joining them, right, at a cost. But now you have people who are no longer standing on the sideline, you know, because police brutality, this is not a spectator sports. You know, people need to speak up and speak out. You know, as John Lewis would say, make some good trouble, right? And the group that Justice for Yuri Stamps, we want to make some good trouble, right? So this doesn't happen again. And, you know, we can't control that. But if you put laws and policies in place, right, that hold police accountable, people's action will be a little bit different.
So, Selvin, to that point, police reform legislation is still under negotiation at the Massachusetts State House. They have essentially until January, and some critics worry that that is enough time to lose the momentum for change. Is Yuri Stamps' story an argument for police reform? And if so, what do you want to see change?
Well, of course it is, right? We don't want police to have any kind of type of immunity. We want to make sure that there's better training in place, that there's a better process for what I call community policing, which is engagement with the community in a non-intrusive way. I think there's a plethora of different things that have to happen, and starts with dialogue and it starts with policies as well, because dialogue alone is not going to change the circumstances.
That's Selvin Chambers, a friend of the Stamps family and a spokesperson for the group Justice for Uri. And a note that Selvin accidentally combined the names of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, two black men who died at the hands of police. We also reached out to the Framingham Police Department asking if they'd like to join today's conversation, but they have not responded. In the fight against the coronavirus, public health guidance has been stick to home when you can, and if you do interact with people outside of your household, stay apart and wear masks. Still, 6 months in, restaurants and many businesses are open. Some are returning to offices. So what is acceptable behavior, and how has that question, asked, of course, from an appropriate 6 feet away, impacted our friendships? Tell us, how have you navigated hanging out with friends in and around your coronavirus bubble? And what about when they expand that bubble outside your control? Maybe you have a new roommate. How do you navigate the rules with them and their partners and their friends? We want you to join us for this conversation. Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have two guests who are also going to join us for this conversation. The first is Margaret Willison, a librarian and culture writer. Welcome back, Margaret.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
And Camille Washington. She hosts the culture podcast, The Unfriendly Black Hotties. Welcome back, Camille.
Hi, it's so good to be back.
So, Camille, let me start with you. How are you in this, you know, depending on how you count it, anywhere from 6 month to 8 month of the pandemic?
Well, I appreciate the question. I've been telling people that I'm like pandemic good. So, not good like for a normal period of time, but very, very good for a once in a generation, like lifetime event.
I guess that's good. Margaret, how about you? I hear you laughing at Camille's answer there.
I love that answer. What I've been saying is that like materially, I know myself to be better off than like 99.9% of people right now, but that things are still as for me as they are for everyone, at least lightly garbage, like lightly to severely garbage. And you get into this guilt cycle if your basic conditions are okay, where you're like, oh, I couldn't possibly feel bad about being cooped up in my apartment because, you know, I don't have to worry about childcare. My job is stable. No one in my family has been sick, so on and so forth. But the thing is other people's suffering doesn't actually make me feel better. It tends to make me feel worse. So I'm just like very worried for everyone in the world, and then also unable to see my friends or hug people, which is a real trial for me. Hmm.
Let's talk about the seeing friends and the trial of that. And Margaret, I'll stay with you for a minute. You live in an apartment in JP, 4-bedroom. Mm-hmm. How has that been? Have you been alone? Do you have roommates? How has that worked?
So I have roommates. I have three roommates. Two functionally moved out for the most part at the beginning of the pandemic to move in with their boyfriends, at least for various parts of the pandemic. So it was just me and my roommate Mallory in what we've deemed Spinster House. In September, my older brother actually moved into one of the rooms in the apartment. And in October, the other room is going to be occupied by a friend moving up from New York. So it'll be a lot more to navigate once there are four of us. And we're lucky we've got a lot of really nice outdoor space at our apartment. So, you know, we have people come and spend time on the patio or spend time on the porch. I was able to do a surprise party and concert with a local musician, Dietrich Strauss, on Saturday in the side yard with everybody staying socially distant from one another. But it's so much more to juggle. And once you add in all the other people, it becomes much, much more complicated. One of our roommates had a boyfriend who was coming and going, and he also had roommates. And that's just like a much bigger pod.
So Camille, does that resonate with you? I know you live with your partner, but you're seeing some friends. And how do you set the rules?
Oh my gosh, it's so difficult. I mean, I've been trying to avoid using the language of rules because I think it's easy for people to feel like you're being judgmental when you talk about things in that way. So I've tried to keep conversations around like, you know, what's your comfort level? What's my comfort level? How, you know, how can we meet each other where we are? And when I'm doing that, I have to understand, like, I don't have roommates. I do have like couple privilege. So my partner and I live together in a 2-bedroom in Cambridge with 2 dogs. So we are very well set up, kind of emotionally for this time. And so for me, I have needed to be really sensitive to the different situations that everyone else is in.
So let me turn to the listeners. And listeners, join this conversation. We're all having this shared experience. And tell us how the pandemic has impacted your friendships, your relationships with roommates, partners, and where you have disagreement on, quote unquote, the house rules or what's allowed or what's a safe practice. What do you do and how has that affected your relationships? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's turn to Jay from Brookline. Jay, go ahead.
Hi there. I have what I've observed based on travels. I've recently been traveling to Arizona is that there's a big change in the tone and the nature of how you need to be protected. And there's a social pressure. If I remember going to a bar, and the patron was like, well, you don't need a mask here. We don't need it. I can't hear you what you're saying. There's that, you know, as if they consider some of the groups even consider that this is like a boxing bout or something. Let me show what, you know, who is more important. So it's kind of a different, when you travel from Northeast to, places like Arizona, and you see the stark difference of how social distancing or wearing a mask or having, you know, washing hands is not considered, quote unquote, cool. And they actually have a name for it. It's called COVID crazy.
Well, and I'm going to take it back, and I'm glad we hung on with you, Jay, through the COVID crazy, because I suspect that's a term we will hear and use again. So turning back to Margaret and Camille, you know, I noticed Jay said in a bar, they said you don't even need a mask. Well, of course, here you can't go to a bar because bars are phase 4 and they're not even open in the Commonwealth. We do see mixed signals, both based on place, but also based on preference. And what do we do with that, Margaret?
Well, I don't know that we see mixed signals so much as mixed reverence for the signals. Like the science has been developing over time, and that's certainly been challenging. But the science right now is very clear. Like, it's not safe to be in an enclosed space with poor ventilation with a number of people whose pandemic practices you're not familiar with. Like, that's a very high risk situation. But because we don't have sufficient support for the businesses and for people working in the economies impacted by those kind of rules, we're just caught in this like capitalist death race, basically between like, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to respect the science that's been put forward about what is safe and what is unsafe? Or are we going to change what's available because it's necessary for restaurants to be open?
So in listening to you on that, I mean, and in all fairness, right, for the restaurant, it is necessary for them to be open. That is somebody's livelihood, right? It's a small business, and our economic survival is important. And this is something I'd be curious to hear from both of you. And since I just heard from you, Margaret, I'll start with Camille, but I'd love to hear from both of you on this. We do not seem to have a consensus on what is safe enough. And I wonder if either of you have thought about that, have talked about that inside your bubble and where you come out on that, because that feels like it's part of what's burning the fault lines between people and communities in this moment. Camille.
Yeah, that question of safe enough, it is a massively, massively difficult question. And I am not a scientist, so I will not pretend to know the answer. But what I do know is what feels safe for me based on all the guidance that we have received. So I have yet to even eat on a patio at a restaurant. There's a way in which I'm like, okay, I would love to see my friends. Of course, people are going out, they're having margaritas on rooftops. I love that for you. But the reality is, if you and me don't live in the same household, how can we be safely distanced from one another, you know, eating or drinking together on a patio. And so that has meant that that's just not a thing that I do. And, you know, the beauty of takeout alcohol is you can take that margarita and go to a park and sit far apart from your friends and have a lovely chat and just feel secure in that knowledge. So that's what I choose to do. It's mask on, you know, within, I don't know, 7 or 8 feet. Cause I feel like the whole 6 feet thing, I feel like people believe that that number is magic. And mm-hmm. I think of 6 feet as being a minimum, right? And so ideally, but, you might want a
but
little
that is
more.
Yeah, so this is the stuff that's interesting, right? Because you feel more comfortable at 7 or 8 feet. But the public health guidance is 6 feet. And that's what I mean, Camille, about safe enough. You don't want to go to a patio with friends, but maybe some of your friends do. I do you understand where I'm coming from on that? I'm so interested in these differences in what makes each of us feel safe.
Yeah, I think it's just about having that conversation, right? And having people around you understand where you're coming from. So I don't live with a person who is at high risk, but my father is at very, you know, in a very high risk category. And so that changes the way that I think about it. Right. And so that, you know, kind of backdoor into my mind, you know, if you're my friend and you don't have that kind of situation with a parent or another loved one, you might have a different threshold for risk. I mean, we're at the point now, 6 or 8 months into this, as you say, however you count it, where we're in this for the long haul. So just sitting in your house all the time is not a viable strategy. But we all have to figure out what's the level of risk that we're each personally able to take on. And then we all have to be grownups and communicate, you know, what risk feels comfortable to us, to the people that we're trying to see.
And I feel like that communication piece, boy, is that at the center of what we're talking about. Margaret, I do want to go back to the phones, but beforehand, I want to give you a chance to reflect and react.
Well, it's funny to talk about all this stuff sort of academically, but like one thing that we haven't established is Camille and I are friends in real life, and we've had to have some of these conversations. We had friends who visited from out of state, and they and I feel comfortable doing like a quick hug as long as everybody has their mask on, right? And Camille did not feel comfortable doing that. And what happened is I stated my comfort level. The people who were receptive to it returned the affection. The people like Camille who weren't receptive to it didn't hug. And like the key thing is everybody communicated clearly. Everybody communicated that like whatever answer was given was going to be received with generosity and patience. And no one took pandemic choices as personal judgment.
Right.
And Camille, I do have to ask, did you feel that that was a warm and understanding environment where you could say, this is what I'm comfortable with, and you would get that support?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes.
That's wonderful.
And I just think it's important. Yeah. Just say it and always know, like, you know, I love you to pieces, but you know, we feel the way that we feel, you know?
Let's and go to the phones here. One, go ahead. No, Margaret,
say,
I want to
so
hear that.
There's so much that we don't know yet. Right. So it's just, it's very hard to calculate risks when we don't have any of the figures to perform calculations with. So it's just everyone making their best guess, and kindness and patience are so important.
Let's go to the phones here. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sarah's on the line from Salem. Hi, Sarah. You're on with all three of us. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you guys?
Well, thanks.
So I like to share my experience about our comfort levels. My boyfriend and I will live in an apartment like less than 600 square feet, and he's way more strict than I am. So that has been very challenging. And one of the funniest things was that we eventually agreed that we can have people over in the backyard and no one comes upstairs. And one day people came to the backyard and it started raining and people had to come upstairs, and he was giving me the looks like, oh, people are coming up, and I had to just tell him to just chill, and we'll see how it goes. So that was definitely challenging for us.
That is challenging. And those unexpected moments, I think, kind of are part of what tinker with us, right? Or toy with us or mess with us when we're trying to establish these distinctions. Did Sarah's story resonate with either of you, Margaret and Camille?
Oh my gosh, that was like a story from my own life. Like last week, my older brother who lives in Chicago, he was visiting, him and his wife, and we had planned to have a picnic, but the weather was miserable last week. And so they needed to come inside the apartment. And my partner and I had a very similar kind of conversation via eye contact. And what we decided we would do is come inside. We'll try and stay as distanced as we can. We'll open a window and we'll keep our masks on. And we'll all get COVID tests ASAP. And that was just like, you know, but would I have done that for someone that wasn't my brother? Probably not. Like, and so that's the other thing that you have to factor into it. Like how badly do you need to see this person? Like, how long will it be before you can see this person again?
Have you both been tested? And have you both been tested more than once? Margaret?
I've been tested, but only once.
I have been tested now twice. And one of the tests I got today.
I'm thinking of getting another one very soon.
Margaret, why are you thinking about getting another one soon?
Because the tenor of things is shifting. My brother has moved in. We're going to be getting another new roommate in October. And just having that information to hand, just knowing that I'm okay right now is important. I'm also really interested in trying to get an antibody test because I had a flu type sickness in February, and I don't believe that it was COVID, but we know so little, and it seems like any amount more you can know is a benefit.
Do you find that your friends, both of you, are responsive to that, are also getting tested, are thinking about, you know, what are we going to do when sniffles and coughs are, you know, sort of the order of the day in the colder months?
Great, I mean, questions.
Yeah, starting to think about that and starting to order my like more industrial grade picnic blanket that can handle, you know, sodden ground and can bear all of the fun weather that we get up here in Massachusetts. But in terms of like thinking about testing, it's not something that we should be doing unnecessarily. But I think if you have someone inside your house unexpectedly, or you go to a gathering and someone hugs you without your consent, which is something that I have heard happen, it can be nice to just, you know, wait a few days and go get a test at one of the many pop-up clinics. I know Cambridge is doing them regularly. The city of Boston is as well. Just, you know, for that peace of mind, like for yourself, and also to be considerate to the people around you. That's how I think about it anyhow.
And well, it's been a pleasure. Oh, no, go ahead, Margaret.
I certainly know people who've taken extreme precautions and still gotten the virus and not really been presenting symptoms. So testing just seems very, very important.
Listeners, have you been tested? Are you satisfied with the results? How frequently do you feel you need to be tested in order to feel safe? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I want to ask you both, you both are observers of the moment, right? You're bloggers, you're a cultural writer. We've been talking a lot among the Radio Boston team about this struggle with wanting to and desperately needing to meet the public health recommendations, dealing with the gap between what we hear from public health experts and what's actually allowed, for example, at the state level, and recognizing that there is a mental health component to being so isolated and so separated. Are you guys seeing those things in conflict? And how, as observers of the culture, would you explain or talk about that? Camille, maybe you can go first there.
Oh, gosh. I don't know that I have a good answer.
Yeah, just a small question for you.
I mean, I think just being intentional about your relationships and like finding ways to make even virtual time together feel more like real and tangible. So, for example, I started a book club that's just me and my one other very good friend. And it gives us an excuse to, you know, check in with each other every couple of weeks and talk about something that is not related to the pandemic or our work stress or whatever, and just like connect. So I think getting like a little creative and stepping outside the box in terms of how we are relating to each other helps, helps us feel more like connected in this time when we're just not able to hug and kiss and hang out in bars the way that we want to.
And how about you, Margaret?
You know, I have a slightly different orientation to this because I'm single and sort of have been trying to date during the pandemic, right? Which means engaging like a certain amount of risk, or at least contemplating a certain amount of risk, and asking the people in my apartment to also take that risk on. And so for a while, there was this terrible dilemma where like you would match with people and like consistently, if somebody was willing to meet up with you in person and maybe not be socially distanced, they were not taking the pandemic leave sufficiently seriously for that to be anything worth contemplating. That was like a very special category. and more I've been finding people who are approaching it sensibly, but are getting to a point now where they're willing to sort of take risks. And it's tough, you know, companionship is really important. Not having to feel like your life in this category is just on ice for a year is important. Mm-hmm. But there are stories like this wedding that we're hearing about in Maine, right, where it was 60 people indoors. And from that, a huge number of people have been infected and 3 people have died, none of whom attended the wedding. And you never want to be one of those stories. And it's so hard to control whether you're going to be.
Yeah. And the main wedding, when you said none of them having gone to the wedding, I think you mean of the 3 people who have passed away.
Correct.
That were
yes.
connected to that spread. Yeah. Camille, what's going to be permanently different now? In our last, 30 seconds or so.
I think something that I want to keep from this time is just the sense of intentionality that I have around my time with others and making sure that time spent with someone is quality time, meaningful time. Yeah.
How about you, Margaret?
In a similar way, one of the really nice things about the pandemic, one thing that's hard is that Camille feels as far away from me in Cambridge as, my friend who lives in Omaha. That's tough because I'm used to having Camille feel really close. But
yeah,
the fact that all of my friends were sort of flung across the country are now suddenly so available to me, and all of these ways of spending time with them have become more plausible. That's great. And I'd like to be able to carry that forward.
That's Margaret Willison, a librarian and culture writer, and Camille Washington, who hosts the culture podcast, The Unfriendly Black Hotties. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.